it just all comes down to basically what we expect when we are being when we are being told information. So we start from a premise. In linguistics, it would be sort of like, you know, the principles of cooperativeness. So we always assume that the speaker or whoever's on the other end telling us this stuff is being honest, is being direct, is trying to, you know, they won't say too much stuff so as not to complicate the issues, but they are trying to, they're not trying to deceive you.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out our podcast, Understanding Our Place in the World. The podcast is brought to you by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. My name is Philip Cosolino, and I am an experimental social psychologist at Essex. My guest today is Dr. Dawn Holford, a behavioral scientist at Essex. Dawn takes a cognitive and psycholinguistic approach to understand how individuals make sense of information presented numerically, such as in percentages, as opposed to information presented verbally or in written words. Dawn and I spoke recently about a number of topics, including her work exploring the varied ways we respond to food labels, and about her participation in an important endeavor to collate the best evidence and best advice regarding the COVID-19 vaccine. We also discussed the critical scientific process known as peer review, and specifically her plans to train future scholars to develop review skills. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Okay, Dawn, thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks, Philip.
So why don't we, I assume you've been listening to some of the podcasts before this one. Why don't we do what we always do, which was kind of start from the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your background, however far back you want to go.
Okay. Well, I'm a behavioral scientist. I did my PhD on basically how people understand food information. So what I'm really interested in that psychology of communication. So how do we process information that we come across, whether that's read, spoken, heard, visual information, and especially to do with quantities, because in the world we don't realize it, but we're always dealing with quantitative information, uncertainties, comparisons. So I'm interested in how we use this in our judgment and decision making, and you know, for the past 5 years or so, I've been looking into it in the context of food labeling. So how are amounts of nutrients in food perceived? Do the words that are used or the numbers or just the context it's in, whether that's an unhealthy food situation or something about health food, how's that influence the way we think about it, the way we interpret that information? And then more interestingly to everyone is how we then make food choices and how we behave around it.
You did your thesis at University of Essex, yes?
Yes.
And but that you didn't do undergrad at Essex, did you?
No, I did that in Singapore. So I first came to Essex to do my master's in psychology. Prior to that, I was at the Singapore Management University doing a business and accounting degree. And then I worked in the civil service, public service in Singapore for a couple of years before coming to England.
That's interesting. So what led you to choose psychology? Had you taken some psych courses and had always in the back of your mind thought that was interesting? Or was there just a need for change, whatever you want to describe?
So this is a really interesting thing because I'd always wanted to take the psych modules at university, but I could never quite get into it. So at my university, you had to bid for modules, and that was always really popular. But also in my previous life, I was an athlete, so I was a sailor. And we did a lot of sports psychology, and that was what really drew me into it. So in the sport of sailing, there's a lot of tactical decision making going on. And I was really interested in what made people be able to make such split second decisions and what factors did we look at in the environment that helped us to make those decisions that quickly. So that was what really led me to go, yeah, I really want to study psychology further. So after I'd retired from the sport and as I quit my job and said, okay, I'm coming to study psychology.
Do you sail at all anymore, or is that is just a part of your past?
I think it's going to stay a part of my past for a while because access to boats are quite difficult. Even before the pandemic, I had to know someone who has a boat.
That's very cool. This is the first, I think you're now going to be the 10th podcast that we've done, and you will be the first athletic sailor. So that's very exciting.
Good to be a bit different.
All right. So then you came here, you got your master's at Essex and then switched into the PhD program. And that was the thesis that you started to describe, which was about sort of food labeling in the context of health.
So I really started from the beginning here, looking at my thesis had three different angles. How do we interpret food information? What do we pay attention to on a food label? And then how do we evaluate the whole thing? So in terms of interpretation, this started out as a sort of comparing the words and numbers that you see on food information. So let's say you take a packet of, cereal or something. You're sure to see things like high fiber or low fat, but you might also see some cereals will tell you, oh, it's got 5% fat or 70% fiber. So this is all really common. And to be honest, I came into this because I had been through the supermarket just one day, just really paying attention to what was around me. And I thought, this isn't actually that clear. And so it became a psychological study. So if you give people high and low amounts of nutrients, fat, sugar, salt, fiber, how do they perceive that? How do they think it contributes to, you know, what they should be eating in a day? And the first thing we found there was that people just tended to overestimate what those numbers, how those words translate into numbers. So according to the really technical guidelines, which I'm sure everyone's read. It was a lot of technical reading to just trying to find out what actually it ought to mean. And so it probably wasn't that surprising that people just overestimated that by far. So if you have a food that says, oh, this is high in fiber, it needs to provide at least 30% of the fiber you're eating in a day.
Okay.
But people were translating that as, oh yeah, it probably gives me 70%. That's a high value. So that seems pretty problematic in and of itself. And then after that, I moved on to what people are paying attention to. So what are they looking at when you give them words and numbers on the label? So we did this really very simplified, just gave them, okay, this has 5% fat or high fiber, high fat, that sort of thing. And we noticed that when we were giving them words to look at, they tended to just look for longer at the information and just really take in what nutrient it was. And then that also sort of skewed how they judged the food. So you might have high fat and then you might think that 70% fat, but then you're going to think the high fat's less healthy than the 70% one, even though you think those are the same values. And that probably brings me to the last sort of set of studies I was doing in my PhD, which was to look at how people evaluate descriptions of food. So basically we looked at meat. In one study, we looked at meat specifically, where you could tell people the content is, 25% fat versus, it's 75% lean. So this is especially the case on minced meat. So it was a very famous study way back that showed that if you tell people the fat content, they think it's worse than if you tell them the lean content, even if it's exactly the same. So we were trying this with words as well, and to try and equalize what each individual person thought about it, and also to try and see, well, what are the words doing? And we actually found that both the words and numbers were making people just concentrate on what that information was. So for example, if I tell you it's high in fat or 75% fat, their attention is directed to the amount of fat there. But then if you say it's low in fat or it's 5% fat, they're actually focused on, okay, so how much fat isn't there in the food?
And does that predict actual consumption or sort of at the store? I mean, were you only assessing sort of perspectives of it, or were you actually then judging likelihood of buying that or consuming it, et cetera?
Yeah, so we were looking specifically at healthiness judgment. So I focused on that particularly because I think that the thing about food information is that it's meant to give us the ability to make an informed choice. So we're meant to read it, and then we should know how healthy the food therefore is. Now, I don't really think we should be making a judgment on people as to, oh, well, then you must buy it or we must change your mind. But I think people have the right to get the accurate information and then decide for themselves. So we want to empower them. We all want to be empowered to be able to make choices that are in line with the right information.
You know, I'm thinking, you know, how many times we see the words like organic thrown on something, or, I was watching, it was a sitcom, I get it, it's a joke, but they flashed by at a supermarket something that said it was bottled water, and it had a big star that said now gluten-free. I'm sure there are some labels out there are trying to play this game of what word can we use that sends the message that it's healthy, and we don't really have to account for whether it is or it isn't.
There is actually, very strikingly, we did find this in one of my later studies that's currently going through the publication process, where we sort of manipulated whether we said the food was providing people with energy or calories. Now, the neat thing about that is that calories and energy essentially are the same thing. But when I tell you, oh no, you have plenty of energy, it sounds great. It sounds like you're going to get up and go and, you know, be able to run a mile on that. But then if I flip that and tell you it's got plenty of calories, it's essentially the same quantity of the same thing, but people suddenly think, oh no, that's horrible. And so that was quite that we did 4 experiments just replicating that. So every time people do think that the energy construction is better than the calorie one, like it's healthier, they like it more, and they even think that it's a recommendation. So they're actually inferring that, okay, the person's chosen to use the word energy because they're recommending this product to me. They think it's healthy as well. I think it'd be interesting to see whether there are real correlations out in the world with just when all this framing is used, and whether these manufacturers just have this intuitive idea that this is what's going to sell to people. But yes, it's true, because people it's not just what's stated in the words. People make all sorts of inferences from what they read. So they think, oh, why did the person choose to use this word? What does that mean about other things? Is it a comparison? So if I say that this meat is 25% fat, does it mean that it's got more fat than other meat? Is it more than typical? So to use the example you used about the not gluten-free water?
Yeah, gluten-free water, yeah.
I've actually seen one that was vegan water.
You've actually seen vegan water? Like it being promoted as this water is vegan?
Well, it was on the packaging. It wasn't an ad or anything, but I saw it. I was like, oh. It's just, it presumes that the alternative must exist. So out there must be some that aren't. So I don't know whether it will seed doubt about other things. But I think those inferences are really important, because we like to think when we're communicating to people that what we've said is just what they should interpret. But then a key part about language is that people make a lot of implicit assumptions about what you haven't said. So if you think about miscommunication, a lot of the times you have people getting into arguments because it's about how they said things, not just what they said. It just all comes down to basically what we expect when we're being told information. So we start from a premise. In linguistics, it would be sort of like, you know, the principles of cooperativeness. So we always assume that the speaker or whoever's on the other end telling us this stuff is being honest, is being direct, is trying to, you know, they won't say too much stuff so as not to complicate the issues, but they are they're not trying to deceive you. that's our starting point, and I think that's essential, because that's how humans have grown. We're social creatures. We have to cooperate in order, you know, evolutionarily, we were able to become, well, we got to where we are because we are a cooperative species. So I guess that assumption that we start by assuming the other person's cooperating with us and just being straight with us is a reasonable one.
I think that links to the next thing that I want to talk to you about, which is this, you're working in the past in your early work on these food labeling issues, but your more recent work communicating of the vaccine for the COVID virus, and how the communications behind the vaccine and around vaccine are influencing individuals. And again, I think that boils, a lot of people are worried about, like, will everyone take the shot? Because some people trust medicine and science less than others. So let's dig in a little bit on that. You're shifting gears now. You're part of this group of people working on trying to help people understand and deal with these COVID vaccinations. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so I'm part of this group called SciBee, and basically it started fairly early in, well, I won't say early in the pandemic, but early last year, around March or April, and when we sort of realize this, all this, suddenly the research focus is getting shifted to COVID, and a lot of papers are coming out, a lot of information, new research is coming out, but that's not really useful to anyone if there isn't good curation, if there isn't good conversations around it, and it isn't getting into the hands of people who can actually use it. So that was always our goal in terms of trying to shape knowledge environment, the information environment. So this was pretty much within a month, like over and over Christmas, we had a group of 62 experts who had come to this workshop we'd run. And we said, okay, look, we want to tackle how do we communicate about vaccines. We're going to write a handbook on this. Get everyone's expertise, all the research you've done. What do you know about misinformation? What do you know about talking to people in healthcare settings? We got the medical experts on board because that information's got to be accurate. You absolutely need to give the correct stuff about introducing vaccines and what the risks are and the side effects and how the vaccines develop. So we put this all together it seems like a crazy amount of time, because I think usually these processes take months. I mean, you probably know what it takes to get a bunch of academics in one place and write something and get them to submit it by a certain deadline. Basically, our focus was, okay, so let's just give a quick overview of vaccines, how they work, and then talk about, well, what's the communication agenda for this? How do we talk to people who might be hesitant, resistant, completely denying its existence? How do we combat that and debunk misinformation? What has research said about getting through to people? What has research said about people who are open, possibly open to ideas, or people who are resistant, but how do we step by step get them to open up and think about new things? And a lot of it is not about the content. One thing we do have in the handbook is just the how educating and directing people to do things isn't such a successful strategy as compared to sharing and then just eliciting their views and listening. So you might be getting the same points across, but how you do it is really important.
So getting letting them have a sort of voice in the conversation and what their concerns might be.
Yeah, and also I think what's important there. So if for example you just really listen and then you say, okay, so this is what, so you think this, you're also getting a check-in to see what sort of inferences they've made when they've responded to you. You're checking that, oh, has the other person actually understood the words you've said the way you intended it for them to understand them? Because that can happen so often. You might think you're on the same page because you understand the meaning of some phrases. So if I say the vaccine's got a really low, it's a really low risk of side effects and they're all really mild, I think I've just said, you know, there's no risk here, it's great.
It's safe, right.
Yeah, but you might have interpreted low as,
it's not zero risk.
Yeah, there's some risk there.
Yeah.
And mild, well, what's mild to different people? So it's important then to just check in and say, okay, well, how have you interpreted low? What's your idea of mild? And if you realize and they say, oh, low is, you know, but that means I could still get it. You then have a conversation about, okay, well, what's your risk threshold perhaps? And then maybe you could compare that to say, well, what happens if you do get COVID?
Is saying low risk, is there a better way to convey this is a safe thing for you to do and not to worry about it than saying low risk?
I think some of the work that's other researchers have done about communicating risk probabilities in terms of figures and maybe also providing the counterfactual could be helpful here. So when you're saying low risk, you have to remember that people think of things holistically. They might infer as well, oh, so what is this risk low compared to what the risk of daily events? Is it low compared to, say, the risk of getting COVID-19? It's really important when you're talking about risk to just specify, okay, what exactly are we talking about here? So maybe it's the side effects, and low risk means that, okay, maybe only one person in 10,000 is going to experience a side effect, and that side effect is virtually never going to kill you. And then what are the policies and procedures in place to mitigate that? And then we're talking about comparative risks to, say, COVID-19. That's a case of, okay, yeah. So maybe acknowledging that, yes, there's always a risk of side effects. And there's some other research that shows that sometimes when you're just straightforward about, yes, this is there, side effects can happen. People, that can increase trust.
I can think of at least three, right? I mean, there's probably more. sort of categories of people who would be resistant, right? You'd have the people who, the word legitimate comes to mind, but it's just like there are segments of the population globally who have legitimate concerns because of past abuse and a past sort of misuse of people from their populations and their cultures in science and, you know, receiving medicines that were perhaps not appropriate to give, et cetera. So there's a hesitancy there. Then there are people who probably are hesitant about it because they're just thinking, I'm healthy, I'm young, right? It's like, I'm sure it's a real thing, but it's just, I don't need it and I'm going to survive. And of course, there's the third category I can think of, which is, wow, you know, Bill Gates has put a chip in it. And, you know, you're some evil cabal, right? So it's like, how can you come up with a handbook that address getting people to take this vaccine when you have so many different ways in which people are going to be hesitant about doing it?
So I think the first thing is to recognize that, as you said, not everyone who is reluctant or says, oh, I don't think I want to have a vaccine, you do not, the first thing is don't classify them as, oh, you're anti-vaccinations. There's so many subtleties there, and therefore communication is a lot about understanding and having a conversation with people. So it's just to understand what exactly is holding them back. So in the handbook, we provide examples of how you could talk to someone like that, and then also listing the different reasons that people might be hesitant to take a vaccine. And yes, like you mentioned, ideological reasons are one of them, cultural reasons, I think religious reasons as well. I think the thing that we've done that's a bit unique about our handbook is also that we've tried to accompany it with this sort of living library. So this is a concept where we've stated some general principles in the handbook, but obviously a PDF is a very static document. You're not going to be able to like update it every time something comes in. But we've made this Wikipedia sort-ish document that links to from the handbook. So you might say have a list of, okay, this is why people might not want to vaccinate. And then each one links to latest information. So we've got a whole page on myths about the COVID-19 vaccine and what the facts actually are, so that we can keep updating that and keep track of it, because misinformation is going to keep coming up. And that would make anything we put in the handbook pretty outdated within months if people start coming up with new myths about it.
Kind of getting back to what we were talking about earlier about numbers and way in which people hear things, low risk, high risk, etc. Over the last, you know, week or so, right, we had another vaccine. They were reporting 60-70% effectiveness. And I remember thinking when I saw that news report, I thought, uh-oh, this is the last thing we need in a world full of hesitant, you know, vaccine takers is reporting that this one is only 60 or 70% effective, when all the experts are saying, oh my gosh, there's so many benefits to this, right? It's a one-shot deal. It doesn't need to be refrigerated at some insanely cold temperature. And apparently it has much, what they buried was it's like 85 to 90% prevents people from any real serious outcomes. So even people who do get it, apparently only, you know, 85 to 90% of them have the minor version of the COVID. So it was like, there was all this information that was not being told, and all anyone talked about was 60 to 70%. That sounds really bad.
Well, guys, here's some big news. Earlier today, Johnson & Johnson announced its single-shot COVID vaccine has completed its global trial and will soon be available. Yep, Johnson & Johnson said their vaccine was proven to be 66% effective. Way to go. 66%? Pretty much the D student of the vaccine world. Not failing, but would really like to bump that average up to a C+ by next semester. Yet the Johnson & Johnson vaccine showed up late and it got a 66%. It's basically the Spicoli of vaccines.
So I think the issue with that is that there's two things that vaccines could do. One would be they prevent you from getting it completely. The second thing would be, well, they prevent you from getting really ill, even if you do get it. And I guess what's clear from a lot of the research and risk perception is that you should always be clear what sort of event you're talking about when you're talking about percentages. So I think in terms of communication, that could always be linked a bit better. And I guess the other thing is, what's the counterfactual scenario? So yes, maybe you've got 60%, let's say there's 60% efficacy, meaning, you know, let's say it's a 60% chance you'll be protected. What's your efficacy, so to speak, if you don't get the vaccine?
But it just struck me as like, you just knew what the average person who was just hearing bullets come across their feed, like, that doesn't sound very good, not compared to what these other numbers, because they're just paying attention to the numbers and they're putting on top of it everything else that they would normally bring to it, whether it's 25% lean, what, you know, it's like it goes to everything I think we've been talking about.
I guess it's not so much about, well, what is that rate, but then, you know, how many people that do then need to take the vaccine? So if we said, okay, well, vaccine is 90% effective, so we only need to get this many of the population in order for it to work. Okay, that one's 60%, so we just need more people to take it.
Exactly.
If that was the conclusion of, oh, it's 60%, okay, we better all get one now, rather than, oh, that's 90%, oh, we don't need one, that leads you to a very different conclusion.
It's great that you've done what you've done. I'm really proud to work with someone who's been a part of something like this handbook. It's people should investigate it. It's great work and needed. So hopefully it's being, you know, used and people are learning from it, and maybe policy even can come from it. So let's hope that that's what all this work leads to. Anything else you're doing? Any sort of a new line of research that's non-COVID related, probably linked to some degree, I'm sure, to your past work, but any other directions that you're going in?
So yeah, a few things in terms of communication. So one thing I am interested in is communicating, well, how we deal with research that's coming up. So you know how a lot of research is now being published as preprints?
Yeah, so...
One thing that's dangerous about that is that it's not been critically reviewed, and actually very few do get reviewed externally by people who say, okay, well, I'm just going to review this piece. And there have been so many efforts during the pandemic to try and speed that up. So I'm part of a group, started a group that's basically looking at, okay, can we train people to conduct reviews using these preprints out there? And can we just start it from undergraduates levels? So as part of your training in a psychology degree. So we're actually just about to start the first pilot on that. We developed a rubric to try and test and to see whether students can take to it. And, you know, it's something I'd be really keen to talk about with people who are teaching this term and beyond, because it's sort of like, well, as one thing you realize as when you get into academia, like really get into it, you realize all this peer reviewing that we're doing, we never get trained for it. I think that's something that helps to shape, you know, how we communicate research and how we critically assess research a little bit better. And that's something that COVID put a spotlight on as well.
You're right. I never took a class on how to review a paper.
You know, it's just like, I think it's been in the past 2 years, I've sort of crossed that threshold from PhD, you know, academic in training to, oh yeah, I'm getting asked to do reviews. I should do this. And this is and just some of it was just following. This is the language that previous reviewers have used. Obviously, I had very good training in that my supervisor actually invited me to say, oh, do you want to like co-review stuff with me? But, you know, that shouldn't be left up to the luck of the draw. What sort of
stuff? Right. Well, exactly. What kind of supervisor you get, what kind of reviewers you just happen to get, because we know that it's really kind of a crapshoot to some extent. You know, if you submit a paper, who eventually your action editor will be, who eventually that person decides should be the reviewers, you know, and it is such a strange, it's such an important part. It's the thing, right, that we try to do. And it does feel like you're right. It's one of those moments where you just, when you're first asked to do it, you kind of are nervous. You're like, oh, I want to do well, but you only really have your own experience having been reviewed to guide you.
And unfortunately, I think some of those experiences are horrible. Like there's a paper out there talking about just how bad some of these comments can be. And also there's a lot of misogynistic comments in there in that paper, which is quite shocking.
So no, I don't know that particular paper that you're talking about, but I've heard, yeah, we've all heard the stories, right? And we all know them. For those of you who are listening who aren't academics, who don't submit for publishing, it is sort of the gold standard that you are taught that the peer review process, right? You taught about peer review, but it's just presented as this thing that makes what we do different from other endeavors, that you are treated with this objective, fair approach by your peers. And then over time, you realize, oh, no, this is just another human process. And it's and biases come in and all sorts of other problems get in the way.
I think that's the thing that we need to get back to, the fact that this is a very human process and there's a human on either end of it communicating about research. It is essentially a discussion. It really ought to be a, okay, how can this get better, rather than how can I shut this down? And I just wonder sometimes whether competition has to do about it, because it's so it has to do with it, because it's so tied into the, well, where you go in academia, do you get a job? Can you find another to live another day? And I think that's warped a bit the way we do science and research, because it should be about building on what's out there and just incrementally increasing knowledge, rather than competing to be the one to have that knowledge.
I am entirely on board with non-anonymous reviewing, like actually, because for, you know, the tradition is that your paper gets submitted to a journal and it comes back from reviewer 1, 2, 3, perhaps, and you have no idea who those reviewers are. And I've reviewed plenty of times and no one's known that I am the reviewer. And I feel very comfortable saying, I feel that we should be expected to put our names next to our reviews. And I feel like that would change the process a bit.
Yeah. I think one argument that's always floated about with that one is when it comes to early career researchers reviewing things and possibly offending like a senior person who doesn't like that they've been critical, and then taking it out on them in terms of career. And I think that's one reason that gets cited a lot for, oh, well, we shouldn't make it anonymous. But I think one way around it could always be like, well, maybe your name won't be attached to it, but the review will be public for everyone to see. So people can actually see that, okay, well, this is the review this paper got, and was that justified?
I understand. I'm not trying to say this, oh, I know. I just feel like clearly it's great that you're talking about it, because I think the process, like I said, I lost faith in the process as it was traditionally being done. So I'm glad someone's thinking about it. And I'd be happy to continue our conversation after the podcast, thinking about ways that I could contribute to that, because I do think it's an important part of science. And I do feel, at least in our field, it's somewhat flawed.
I don't disagree that reviews we should have worked towards completely like named reviewers. So basically that reviews should be published alongside, you know, papers and stuff like that. Because right now it is just a black box. We don't know what reviews we've got. I've got one that's probably got like 10 reviews by now as it's going through different, you know the drill.
Yeah.
And obviously I had like one that went through really easy, which is, you know, it's funny because I have my own opinions about the relative qualities of the paper. But I think it's sort of, you have to work towards it in incremental steps in that. Yeah. And it's about making sure the risks aren't borne by the people who are least capable to take it on.
There are different ways and different approaches that we can take. I remember I worked with Minnesota, where I was getting my PhD, Alex Rothman, who's a health psychologist, basically argued at one point, I don't know if he would still agree with this, but when I was there, he was always arguing where basically at some level, once you get a PhD, and this was, he was making this case because it was becoming the new modern era with computers and space, et cetera, and online journals and all that stuff. He was basically saying, once you get your PhD and you're conferred and you have a job, you're guaranteed X amount of space in journals. And that's it. And you just, it'll go through the most basic level of checking at the journals for typos, for, you know, anything that glares a bad product that would be bad for the journal. But other than that, you put your name on the product and people can read it and they can make their decisions as to whether they think this is good work, valid work, interesting, et cetera, and correctly done. But that's it. You're given some space and you fill it up through the course of your years per year. And it was a really kind of novel notion that, you know,
that he was already coming to the opinion that peer review and all this sort of process wasn't necessarily helpful, and it may actually be keeping ideas from getting read and learned about. And he argued that if something was meaningful and impactful, it would grow from there. People would read it, go, oh, I want to follow this, and they would just go. And if it didn't, you'd know, I guess, I'll move on to something else.
I think we actually have that opportunity to do that now, because there's all these preprint servers, and to be honest, a lot of things are appearing as preprints even before they go into journals. And it doesn't bar them from going to journals. It's just, well, we've got this platform and it's publicly accessible. Anyone in the world can just go to a preprint server, read the preprint, critique, think of it for themselves. And I'm, you know, with these groups, we're thinking about, well, how can we get these reviewed as well? So there's actually this site called Pre-Review that just works fully on getting preprints reviewed, so that, well, they could probably benefit from it, and then it can still go to a journal if they want to. But basically, what if we just took that review process and just applied our own critical thinking, maybe facilitated by a sort of some sort of standard checks that means, yes, this has been validated, it's not a lie, it's you can rely that the data's sound, the data's out there.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, you know, what sort of narrative around it is up to all of each of us.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting approach, and I'm really glad to hear that you're thinking about anything, even in the context of, even if teaching and training still keeps it in the standard format for now. I think anything that people are thinking about in terms of improving the process and thinking about ways to improve the process, I think is exciting, because I think for a lot of people out there, it became a process that was less than what was sold and frustrating. And I think we want to get rid of that, because there are probably some really great thinkers out there who are doing less than they would want to do because of the experiences they've had. And that would be a shame if something like that got in the way of people asking good, important questions.
No, I think there definitely is that case. So I mean, my experience sometimes there's one paper I really got right now that has gone so many times, and it's sort of like, okay, I'll change it because these people said these things, and then it goes to another set of people and they say that instead, and it goes back to the original version, and you bounce around people so many times, you just realize nobody actually agrees. A lot of these are subjective opinions, but what is the actual, what's really important in the paper?
Dawn, thank you so much for coming on today. I hope this was a pleasurable experience for you.
Yeah, it was a good chat. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, good. So stay safe and we'll talk soon, okay?
All right.
And thank you once again for checking out the Understanding Our Place in the World podcast. This podcast was produced by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. Make sure to check us out again, as we'll have another interview for you to enjoy in the coming weeks.